Welcome to Podcast Ed, the podcast of RedefinedOnline.org, covering the stories behind the new definition of public education. On this episode, Step Up for Students President Doug Tuthill talks with Antonio Perez, the founder of Walnut Hill Workshop, an organization dedicated to facilitating learning opportunities in unique ways. Antonio discusses his work in Colorado with unique education businesses such as Prenda and MyTech High, how funding can better be made portable for families to tailor their education experience to meet individual need, and how public-private collaboration can break down the false dichotomies about education choice. All that and more on this episode of Podcast Ed. Thank you for listening and enjoy the episode.
Today, I'm really excited to have Antonio Perez. Antonio is the director, or I guess owner, CEO of the Walnut Hill Workshop. So Antonio, welcome.
Thank you so much, Doug. I really appreciate you having me.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you. We had a conversation late last week, and you're doing some really amazing things in Colorado. And given all the momentum towards ESAs in Florida, I thought it'd be important for people in Florida and around the country to hear the really innovative things that you're doing in Colorado. But first, I thought I'd just pause a little bit and ask you, what exactly is the Walnut Hill Workshop?
Walnut Hill Workshop is a manifestation of kind of my work thus far in education. It is the platform and the vehicle from which I can move forward an education agenda and ecosystem and sector and view, which really centers what I believe is, you know, the most important people, learners, families, and educators in the work. And I think oftentimes, as I've worked in districts and charter schools and nonprofits, it's hard to find the right place, right? If you have a vision and a view that is disruptive, that is innovative, that is unique, that challenges a lot of status quo, sometimes it's hard to find your home. Especially if you're driven by a set of values that maybe others sometimes are not. And so I had to really build my own. And so Walnut Hill is my vehicle, is my place to do this incredible work that I've been so lucky to do all of these years.
Talk to me about how you got to this point. I mean, how did you get into education? How did you get into education choice? You've done some pretty cool things. So I just want our listeners to hear a little bit about your background.
Well, I started as a teacher. I graduated from CU Boulder. That's a family thing. I'm like the third generation of Podesses to graduate from CU Boulder. And then I went to teach. I taught in South Texas in the Rio Grande Valley at IDEA Public Schools. And the very first experience I had in education had to do with a school of choice. And then I watched as families across the Rio Grande Valley chose IDEA Public Schools over local private schools, over magnet schools. They were drawn to what we were offering. And for me, it just seemed like a no-brainer, right? It was that somebody would be a parent, would be a very engaged consumer of education. And I think it could even go back, you know, some of my belief in education choice goes back prior, which is I was privileged enough to be part of a family that could buy a home based on schools. And I don't say that now in retrospect. I say that remembering sitting at a McDonald's in Fort Collins, Colorado, watching my parents discuss the house they wanted to buy. And right. It was close enough to this specific elementary school we wanted. So to me, I think that just seemed very normal that, you know, you make choices as a family, right, to ensure your child has the best education possible. And then, or the education that best fits them. And I then taught in a school that was choice. I then came back to Colorado and worked in Denver Public Schools, where we opened innovation schools, which are traditional public schools that have a lot of the autonomies and freedoms charters have elsewhere. And here in Colorado, helped open charter schools, helped redesign district schools. And we were creating choices for families in a community where they had some schools that were underperforming and also lacked thematic choice, if you will, or diversity in school model choice. And so that, you know, that experience early on carried into the rest of my time. And so I ended up working for the mayor of Denver, and it was the first time that I had ever experienced education not through a district. And I wondered, how do you have impact in a community from the city when you're not in control of the district? And so much of it had to do with providing information to parents. Ensuring that they had the time, resources, access to others, right, that could help them make decisions about their kids' schooling. But it also is about making choices about, should I get a library card? Should I join an after-school program? What's the right after-school program? We were big involved with the after-school program. And so, again, another key moment in my career helped me see the value of and the importance of choice. And again, if I go back in time, that's not surprising. What family is not a consumer of education at some point? My parents chose Sesame Street for me as a kid. They chose summer camps for me. And then that landed me at the Don L. Kay Foundation, which, you know, you have a history with. And they are an innovative foundation in Colorado that really wanted to rethink, if you centered learners and their families at the heart of the education system, what might it look like? Don L. Kay was an incredible place to work. I had never been anywhere where the folks who worked there had so much freedom and space themselves to wrestle with what is the vision of Colorado we have? What does this mean collectively? What does it mean individually? What role does education writ large, not just districts, but all learning that happens, play in getting us there? And then what's our role? And the beauty of the Don L. Kay Foundation is we were grant givers. We also played in the advocacy space. We were conveners. We were thought leaders. And for me, it was a chance to get out there and be in between policy and implementation. I started alongside of the executive director, Tony Lewis, with a pretty simple question when I got there in 2017, which was, if we looked at state revenue sources, if we currently look at the way per pupil is allotted, if we look at the way districts can partner with other providers such as community colleges, right, for concurrent enrollment, how many different ways can we make money portable? What are all the different in statute, in the current laws, rules, and regs? How many different ways can you take money outside of the district to other educational services? And it is the district or the state authorized charter that, of course, is the sponsor of that. They're making that determination. And we just wondered, what does that look like? We knew there was concurrent enrollment, but there was much more, right? There was supports for special education services. There was the ability to contract out specific pieces of the K-12 education. And then we came across a really interesting piece of statute that had to do with districts wanting to support the homeschool communities that were that lived within their boundaries. And many years ago, I'm sure decades ago, right, the state created a section of statute that said students can be part-time. And a part-time student can be a private school student or a homeschool student. They're not receiving a full-time education from a public school. And they can basically, alongside of the district or the school, pick and choose the things that work for them that they need. Maybe they need ninth grade geometry. Maybe they need seventh grade history. Maybe they needed access to art programming, right, and other students. And districts in Colorado had been doing that. And we wondered, as you start to look at that and you start to realize all of the innovations and freedoms that already exist in statute, if we started to draw them out and connect the dots, were there opportunities for us to create additional educational options for families and learners that were accessible? So in other words, funded right through the public system as we know it. And that really was at the heart of the work that I did for 3 years with Don L. Kay, which led to me most recently with Walnut Hill being lucky to work alongside of Walton Family Foundation, the Charles Koch Institute, as they think about how to invest in this kind of permissionless out-of-system space. It's given me the opportunity to support Prenda, a for-profit micro school company, MyTech High, a for-profit homeschool company, as they look to expand to Colorado. We use that part-time per pupil loophole, if you will, statute, rule, reg, and brought them in and found them districts and charter partners and families that wanted them, right, and connected those dots and have been able to create from my time through Don L. Kay to even now, 4 years later, since I started Don L. Kay, we've been able to create about 1,200 additional educational options for families. We have 1,200 students across the state of Colorado accessing some form of learning sponsored by a local district or charter school. Be it a micro or a homeschool program or an outdoor leadership program or an online program.
So I want to do a little deeper dive in some of that, but you raise a really interesting point, which is in a lot of states, You've done a great job in identifying Colorado with Tony and Amy and the other people out in Colorado. But a lot of states have way more flexibility hidden in different statutes than people realize. And little pockets of innovation have existed way off the beaten track and oftentimes dealing with a handful of kids in all kinds of unique kind of areas. But most of those go unnoticed and unutilized. And so it's really great that you've sort of highlighted these things and brought them up and started to ask, okay, how can we use these little opportunities of innovation that are hidden in state statutes over the years? And that's really a great example for other folks around the country to think about and going through their state statutes. So let's dive a little deeper into, suppose I'm a school district and or a charter school, however it works, and the legislation allows me to serve part-time schools. Give our listeners a little deeper understanding of what the possibilities there are.
Yeah, sure. So let's start with, you know, in Colorado this year, we're nearing $8,000 per student, baseline per pupil revenue from the state. It's a little under, but we'll use 8,000 because I think it's really mathematically easy for us. So in Colorado, a full-time student receives $8,000. That's what a district receives from the state to service the student. There's additional dollars, right, that come through from federal programming or state program or weighted. But at the base is $8,000. If a student is not full-time, so in other words, they're not enrolled at a public school, they're homeschooled by their family, they're in a private school, those students are still, in the state of Colorado, able to access up to part-time education funded publicly. Historically, what that's looked like is you were doing homeschool at your house, your child has hit ninth grade geometry, you struggled in trig when you were a junior in high school, you know you need someone to help you. And you go down to your local school and you say, hey, you know, I homeschool my son, my daughter, my child, and I would like to know, can I sit them in this semester's geometry class? And the answer from the school, oftentimes use approval from the district, unless they're a state authorized charter, then the charter could decide themselves. They can say, yeah, we'd love to, because they can enroll that student as part-time, receive half of that $8,000 from the state, so just approximately $4,000, and be able to easily fund an additional seat or two or three, as long as that student isn't receiving more than about 90 instructional hours a semester, that student can take a number of courses at a local school. And so that's kind of the way it looked very traditionally, right? Was we came to the district as a homeschool community or parent, or maybe even a private school. Maybe we're a local private school. We were just too small, right, to have the economy of scale to have an art teacher. So our private school students enrolled in your school and used your art class. And it was, for most districts, that's a great way to serve all the kids in your district. Probably aligns with your mission. It allows you to keep your enrollment up. And likely the cost of adding that additional seat is not the equivalent, right, to the revenue received.
Yeah, I was gonna say that seems pretty profitable. If I can add one kid into an empty geometry seat and get $4,000 for it, bring it on, man. There is a
financial incentive for sure.
Yeah.
And then the question that we wanted to ask was, does it have to be done? What does it look like to serve that student? Does it have to be that ninth grade geometry class? Does that class have to be on campus? Does it have to be led by a teacher from the school? What subjects could this cover? Were all the questions we started to ask. And when you pair the part-time per pupil revenue model with the ability of a district or a state authorized charter school to contract out services, any, including educational, you can get into some interesting ideas. And potentially you could have, and we do have a number of districts and state authorized charters here in Colorado that enroll students and contract their services out to providers that usually those families and those students have already identified and are working with themselves. And the district sees them as a partner, creates a really nice public-private partnership, and funds and helps fund and support a portion of that child's education. Now, it still has to meet the same expectations that any public program would. So, you know, hours, some level of expectation, of course, of the standards. And also, you know, you have to be, the funding cannot go to religious education. But if you met a secular micro school that really wanted to enhance their art program, and you yourself could not add seats to your class, your art class, or basically loan out your art teacher, you could enroll those students and then contract out to somebody else to provide those students with art. And so all of a sudden, we saw the opportunity to create new options programs that were beyond the traditional, where the district was providing the instruction themselves or adding a homeschool or private school student to a class. Instead, we said, wow, if you have this freedom and ability to use this part-time and you can pair it with contracting, what's possible? And in that, we have seen Prenda micro schools now is here in Colorado, both using a full-time model with a charter school in Colorado Springs, but also using the part-time model statewide with one of our BOCES, or our Boards of Cooperative Education Services. We also have MyTech High serving almost 1,000 students across the state using this model. And then we have a lot of like local homegrown partnerships where a local private school made a partnership, right, with a public school, where a local nonprofit, a local university, a local business, individuals in the community could be contracted, right, to provide services. And we've really opened the door to a lot of innovative options. And though the money still comes through the district or a school or a state authorized school, there is this opportunity to pair that with more choice, because a lot of these families and learners are bringing to the districts the partnerships that they're excited about and they need support with.
So I'm a school district, and a homeschool cooperative with 12 families comes and says, we want to access our part-time dollars. We'd like you to contract with our homeschool co-op. Maybe one of the parents is a certified teacher, and we're going to give you a, 10% cut for administrative overhead. And in exchange, that $3,600 goes back to per family goes back to the homeschool co-op to offer services in that co-op. Is that pretty much how it works?
Absolutely. That is a great example. There was a small kind of homeschool cooperative in their way to evolving into a micro school. We all know these are all very like kind of nuanced, gray right. terms at times. Right. But what really started this was meeting a group of 20 families in Southern Colorado, rural Colorado, Latino families, probably in one of the lowest performing and just kind of unfortunately not one of our best led operationally districts in the state. And right. they opted out. These were families that didn't have money, that didn't have other choices. There weren't charter schools, and they opted out, and they were homeschooling their kids together, right? They were coming together because not all of these parents could provide some of the education that other parents could, who were former teachers, who were a professor at a local local or an instructor at a local community college. And they came together and over time created a micro school of about 20 kids. And they were doing it all for free, volunteers. Right. And I remember meeting them and I said, how much does this really cost to operate? And we went through their budget and talked about it. And it was the first time I saw, I was a secular micro school running, still using Common Core standards, because these were public school teachers, right, running these classes. They used NWEA as their assessment. Their growth rates were higher than any surrounding district or charter school within like probably a good 20 or 30 miles from this little mixed group kind of project-based school that they created that, by the way, centered who they were, their culture. They cared a lot about racial, social, environmental, and food justice. They didn't get that at their school. And so they built something that gave them that. And we were able to find them partnership with the charter school that was project-based, cared a lot about justice, right? Very hands-on, external facing. Their kids are out in the community a lot. And they found each other, these partners, and they saw one another and their passions and their values in one another, and they established a private-public partnership where that micro school is actually housed inside of a nonprofit in their hometown, and the charter school enrolls the students, handles all the enrollment and administration and attendance data rolled to the state, contracts that nonprofit out to provide a course or two for those students. And all of a sudden, we've infused into this micro school public money. The public school that is sponsoring it is ensuring that this is meeting the expectations of a public program, is of high quality. And now all of a sudden, you've got families with another option that best meets their needs.
Is there any kind of geographic limitations? In other words, could a school district partner with homeschool co-ops or micro schools around the state, or they can only partner with entities within their geographic area?
Yeah. A lot of what we saw in statute makes clear that a district cannot break another district's kind of boundaries to serve students in a full-time program. So in other words, the answer is yes, you could be a district that serves students across the state as long as they were part-time, because you are not operating a full-time program within the boundaries of another district. Now, if it just comes from decorum, you may not want to do that, right? And another district may not want to ruffle the feathers of another district, which is very understandable. Because charter schools in Colorado don't have geographic boundaries, right? So that is, they are not beholden to those same kind of things, be it but legally or decorum. And so they are really a great option and a great place to sponsor these alternative education pathways and options for families across the state. And I think that in the face of COVID, right, and as we've learned, as district and school leaders have learned, right, so much from this moment, one thing is, how do you best serve your kids in the face of a horrible situation, a worldwide pandemic? But also what you're learning is some of these kids just did really well in different options that you can still sponsor, that you're still supporting, that you can still have a quality check on. And from a business perspective as a district, you know, you have a lot of capabilities, a lot of capacities, assets, right, that you can tap into. One of them is the fact that you can run quality control and that you have access to a number of families, your distribution point. If you are a leader who is comfortable with the idea that we may not as a school run this entire program in-house, but we will partner with somebody, which, by the way, schools do all the time in a whole host of their operational, in a whole bunch of their operations, you have the ability, you know, as a school leader to further your mission, increase your enrollment, serve your current kids better, add additional kids. And also in the face of what we saw with COVID, we lost kids.
Right.
We wonder where they are. In Colorado, we're talking about 25, 30,000 kids that have just kind of disappeared. And if there was more of this, if districts, and by the way, this is not a criticism of them, that it could not be busier. I could not fathom right now, right, what it is to run a district and a school in the face of COVID. However, you know, if they had seen this right before, because so much of this is seeing is believing. And if you know you can do this, then I think you could have seen a lot of schools get out there and say, hey, I'm not okay that we can't find these 4,000 kids. And we, if we go and talk to them, we can potentially contract out and support them and contract out services and support them through different options and modalities. And I do think that that helps. And I think that it also is, you and I talked about this last time, the education sector is not one. There's not one just education marketplace. It is made up of many, many small jurisdictions. And we oftentimes talk about this educational choice movement. We talk about vouchers. We talk about education savings accounts. Those are things where we're waiting to get states, you know, to buy into that. You all are so lucky, I feel like, in Florida with the kind of options that you have going. However, why wait? It's, you know, you can go out there and find the leaders and the systems that want to do this, and they can play a role in this. And I think that also makes it a little bit easier for people to trust in these alternative options. You know, if you're a family that a micro school would not have been your normal choice, but your district is telling you that they've partnered with one, right? And you're like, I trust my district and I want my kid in person, but I'm not ready for them to go back to, you know, a school with 200 kids right now. But they told me Prenda is a good option. They told me the micro school being run down the street at this local nonprofit is a good option. They're sponsoring it, right? It's accessible for me with our month, with our dollars. That is, I totally agree. I think that that kind of moment, that example, that situation is something that we could see a lot more of in the future.
It seems like it's a marketing no-brainer for a smart superintendent, because it's a chance to let people inside your system that may not necessarily be comfortable, homeschool families, et cetera. And once they start developing a relationship, they might become comfortable and you might begin to recruit some of those families in to become full time. So, you know, it's sort of like, you know, taste the goods and see if you like it. And if you do, you know, here's some more. So the other thing that's kind of exciting is you begin to break down these false dichotomies where, these micro schools or home schools or private schools are trying to destroy public education. They're trying to privatize, they're trying to, you know, all the all the things you hear, none of which, by the way, are true, but nonetheless, but as people start working together and collaborating and you can create win-win solutions, which is what you're doing with your programs, it might start to ease some of that false contentiousness and really lead to more collaboration, which ultimately will benefit kids and the public good.
Absolutely. I think about when we looked at the data, so I'm lucky enough to sit on the statewide charter school, the statewide charter authorizer here in Colorado, the Colorado Charter School Institute. I'm a board member. And we were looking, we look at how many of our schools during COVID have been in person, have been hybrid, or have been remote. And this isn't going to be a surprise to anybody because this is research has been coming out around the country. Lower income families, period, but definitely lower income African-American, Latino, indigenous families are the most likely to be experienced remote learning.
Right.
However, we all know remote learning doesn't work for everybody. Right. As a family, you may not be comfortable with the idea of, you know, sending your kid back to a 200 person school yet. Right. And so one of the things I think about is we are seeing families who, other than maybe having these magnet schools or charter schools, right, who remote learning from their charter or district was insufficient. They started to create the pods. We've started to see, right, the after school boxing clubs in Oakland that turned themselves into a tutoring program for every subject and brought in online content. Right. Some of these people did this in partnership with districts. Right. And they were supplementing. Some folks went out and built things that were just kind of free and supplanting. And you saw it amongst families who may not have traditionally stretched into that level of choice or seen it as an option. And those families are going to, a lot of those families reside in lower income communities. They reside in certain rural communities and a lot of urban areas. And I think that those, they are constituents of folks who may not have seen the benefit yet, right, of choice. And so, again, when you see something so disruptive like COVID and you see the response and who takes advantage of it, and it starts to shift our mindsets over what's possible, be it that you were, maybe your barrier was that you've just been a traditional, you know, superintendent all your life, or you're a union teacher, or you're someone who believes only in ed choice, right, free of the system. All of these things are being challenged in the face of COVID, and we're seeing these really interesting partnerships. And I think that they definitely help ease some of this. And you start to open up people who may not have traditionally been comfortable with this to it being an option, especially when it's their constituents that are using those options, and those options are working for them really well in this moment. And maybe they'll work better into the future. That's a feedback loop, right, between elected leaders who are thinking about policy and legislation in the future, and their voters in the face of, you know, COVID. This is an interesting feedback loop.
Do you think it's possible in a place like Colorado that as you begin to innovate with some of these things that are already on the books, that it might open up the possibility for additional innovation in policy? I mean, could a sort of a full-blown ESA evolve out of what you're doing with the part-time program? And could it be that the school districts and perhaps even the teacher unions would be less hostile if they understood that kids benefit, families benefit, and school districts can also benefit, you know, by being able to deliver services to families that historically have been hesitant to work with them?
I mean, I hope that that's the case. And what I'll say is what we've seen is, as you are trying out these new partnerships, as you're creating additional pathways and options, I look at this and I think about some of the programs, public-private partnerships that have been created. There's a rural district, Southern Colorado, that partnered with a local nonprofit to offer their homeschool students outdoor leadership programming. And so again, this is a district course in a sense, right? Contracted, run by a nonprofit, contracted by the district, serving this district's part-time students. And when I look at that, I think that that makes a lot of sense. And if I was that superintendent, if I were other families, I would start to wonder, well, wait a minute, I'd like my kid to have an option like that too. But potentially the idea of splintering your per pupil, right, for your full-time kids may not be the right, it doesn't work for you, right? The business model won't work. You may start to wonder, well, what would it look like if there were dollars on the table for my families to purchase these kind of additional services? What does it mean if a family can hire a tutor? What does it mean if a family can put their kid in the summer camp of their choice? What does it mean if they can have their student who maybe like from an art perspective is super advanced, they're going to do better with a local artist in their gallery, right? And you may want to be hiring them on an hourly service. Like, I think that as you see the options exist out there for other families and you see your district running these, the district see the benefit of this, how can you not start to wonder, well, I'd like a little piece of that. And how much of that makes sense to happen through a school versus how much of that is maybe new legislation. And to your point, new legislation that could include, let's say, out-of-system options, which is or out-of-school options, which is something that you all have in the form of your tutoring program and your reading scholarships. It's a conversation that the Don L. Kay Foundation and Reschool Colorado are having here on the ground about being able to create an out-of-school kind of like scholarship program for low-income families. The people who can be the supply side of that, the folks that could provide the services families are looking for, are often going to be teachers.
Yeah.
You want to have a good reading tutor, who better than your child's reading teacher? And, you know, so I think, and also, why can't a district offer and open up, right? Because they have assets. They have rich assets. They have facilities. They have technology. They have caring adults. They have educators. They're trusted. They could become a provider, right? In a world in which kids are, using some, let's say, state dollars, be that tax credit or general funds, to, let's say, purchase additional services outside of the traditional school system. And we know that families that are engaged in that and those children academically perform stronger. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of upside here. But you got to keep in mind, and I think this is there's a nonprofit here on the ground called Ready Colorado, led by a gentleman named Luke Ragland. And Luke, I've always thought, has done a great job of saying, this is a big thing we're talking about. It's publicly funded, so we all have some interest and stake in this, but it's all about a lot of individual decisions. And we got to create and think innovatively about creating as many opportunities for people to select the school or the educational experience or learning provider that fits them best. And that's everything from, you know, in-district options to across-district options to charter schools to homeschool to micro schools to these part-time partnerships to ESAs and vouchers. And so I do think that, you know, when you start talking about it as a much broader bucket, and many of those are things that districts, right, do, I think it starts to dial down the temperature and open up people's minds to what's possible.
And I also think that people would start to be attracted to the small business development opportunities. Like you said, a full-time district teacher can now suddenly also supplement income with an after-school tutoring program, a summer tutoring program. Once families have some more disposable income to spend on learning outside of schools, which we've underestimated for years, my colleague Matt Ladner has done a great job showing the data where the spending between affluent families and non-affluent families is growing. The gap is growing exponentially. And, you know, you can't talk about equity, as you know, Antonio, by ignoring that. I mean, almost all of us have very rich learning experiences outside of school. And we were fortunate to have those of us who had those, were fortunate enough to have families that could access those for us, you know. But a lot of families can't access those. And so I think the whole opportunity of learning outside of school and teachers and other folks in the community being able to create small businesses and grow small businesses, particularly in inner cities. As we talked before, a low-income parent with two kids can be a facilitator, a learning guide at a Prenda micro school and make $45,000, $50,000 a year. That's transformational, you know, in that family. And that wouldn't be possible without some of the innovation we're talking about. So I'm hoping that people are interested in economic and racial and social justice will also see empowering local communities to have the spending power to create and support small businesses, small educational businesses, and people in that community, as well as supporting, you know, traditional schools, I think is a very powerful thing.
And I think there's like two things out of that really land with me is, to your point, is one is the current system as we know it, the current public K through 12 system. And to be honest, if we kind of look at the more established status quo K-12 private system, they're exclusive. of workforce. They're exclusive to kind of like families, to learning styles, to histories, to cultures. And it's not this, it's not that they're doing it on purpose. These things are designed to get the outcomes that they get, right?
Right.
And we ask so much of them. But in all honesty, if I am, a family that's looking for some additional learning experiences that are very culturally relevant to me, it may not be my school that offers it.
Right.
I may want to get it outside of my school. And the person who can offer it is likely a community member, someone here on the ground who cares, who knows the history, who can do this, who, to your point, like would not be in a position to be hired as a teacher, as a licensed or certified teacher, but is an educator.
Right.
I think that is something in the system that we have, we've devalued, and this goes back to some of this out of system learning too. We've devalued the learning that takes place in lots of places.
Right.
We overemphasize the learning that happens in a district. And by the way, that makes sense. They are a single supply chain. They have stackable functions. So in other words, they provide childcare, learning, jobs, facilities and space, safety, nurses, right? It goes on. It makes a lot of sense. But they are one node in the learning ecosystem. And for me, that's actually one of the biggest takeaways from COVID. And I just don't think we hear enough people talking about is system leaders, foundation leaders, right? Policy leaders is when the district, when that node went dark inside of a learning ecosystem, those kids didn't stop learning. They were getting their learning from all the other nodes they were connected to, all the other learning providers, their parents, the Sunday school, their barber, right? The mentor down the street, like they kept getting those things. And there are questions about, you know, how do we value that? And we know those strengthen kids and only helps the district work it easier. And so if I was a superintendent and coming out of this, I'd be pushing my city and district and state leaders to think about how we make sure those kind of those additional learning providers in an ecosystem are accessible, right, and funded and are high quality. That is stuff that becomes super important to me because I saw what happened, right, when I wasn't able to provide the instruction I'd been providing for decades, if not centuries. I do hope that people take the opportunity that COVID has provided us to reflect on the system that we've had, to think about how its reaction, right, in the face of something, only furthered the inequities that many of us, I think, had seen and were concerned with, and wonder about as we rebuild into a new normal, how do we smooth more of those inequities out? And I personally believe, of course, that some of the work that you're doing, that I've been doing here on the ground, others across the country have been doing, can help lead to that. But I really do hope that a lot of people take an opportunity to think about this and wonder about, you know, we can't go back to normal, the pre-COVID normal. It wasn't working for enough families. So I just hope people take the time to really reflect on that, think about it, and wonder how they can play a part in building a new, more equitable, accessible normal.